WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We've had our guest this hour on the program before to talk about their delightful romp through the lives, fortunes, and misfortunes of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. We found out all kinds of things we didn't know, and in some cases, at least in retrospect, didn't want to know about the men responsible for founding the country we call home. Well, now they've turned their attention to other information about America, the kind of information that all good Americans really should know. Again, they've assembled these nuggets of knowledge in a way that is entertaining, and that should come as no surprise, considering that one of the authors of Stuff Every American Should Know spent part of her working life as head writer for the TV show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Of course, she's also written for The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and has produced shows for ESPN, MSNBC, and others. Denise Kiernan is also married to her co-author, Joe Dagnese, also a journalist who has written for The Times and The Journal, as well as Discover and Wired, and won numerous awards and has been featured twice in Best American Science Writing. They are both with us in our Spirit Square studio, and I'm looking forward to what we have in store this hour. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for having us back.
People should know that you live in the mountains of North Carolina, right?
We do.
We do, right up the road in Asheville.
Well, it's nice to have you make the trek down here. I want to thank you for your book on so many levels. Stuff Every American Should Know. I have to read a lot of books for this show, and most of them have no pictures and a lot of words. Your book has no pictures, but it also doesn't have a lot of words.
we were so thinking of you when we did this. We'd sit at the computer and go, what does Mike want to see?
Right.
What would make him happy?
Now, you've done books on the Declaration of Independence and on the framers of the Constitution. Is that where the idea for this came from? Is this the third of a trilogy? Or is there going to be more?
This is
another Hobbit book.
This is the redheaded stepchild in the trilogy, if that's the case. What happens when you start digging into American history is you start amassing odd little facts that you start throwing out at dinner parties or when you're on the phone with your editor trying to impress him or her. And eventually someone will come back to you and say, you should put that in a book, especially if you're a writer. In this case, the publisher had a little series called the Stuff Series. That's what I call it anyway. Stuff Men Should Know, Stuff Women Should Know.
Stuff New Parents Should Know.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so he contacted us one day and said, what about putting together a book of American trivia? But we're, being writers, we're like, that's fantastic. And we're assuming that it would be about as long as the other books we had done. And he said, no, you don't understand. I want this to be a really small sort of gift-sized book. And
hold it up here in the studio so the audience can.
I was just thinking about this. This is a wallet-sized book, and the only thing that prevents you from putting it in your back pocket is that it would hurt if you sat on it.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
If it was soft cover, it would be ideal.
Yeah, it would be
exactly. No, one of the comments we get, we've done several signings for it, and we did one not long ago in Williamsburg.
Is there room for your signature?
I know. It's like we write very small. But one of the things he said is that, the tourists, they can just stick it in their, stick it in their pockets. And, it's a good book to in the car with the kids. And
What made me laugh, actually, was when he told me the actual number of words, I think it's 10,000 words, that he wanted to fit into this book. And that saddened me initially because I had always thought it would be great to have a book that would have both the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution in one pocket-sized volume. Well, those two documents alone come in at just under 10,000 words.
Yeah.
So we managed to get the Declaration in, but the Constitution you can get in our other book.
Yeah.
Or there are tons of other books.
You got the Gettysburg Address in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Brevity was the – yes.
Well, it's interesting. You're both writers, and writers write. And I had a friend who wrote long, inspired articles for, like, the Washington Post and then was commissioned to do a couple of things for USA Today. And he was like, I don't want to do that, write for those people. Ooh. It's short, it's brief, it's chunky. Ugh. And then he sat down to do it. He said, this is the hardest thing I've ever done.
I was hoping that's where you were going with that, because what I was going to say is when we were talking about this project early on with the editor, and he was saying, you know, I want it to come in at around 10,000 words, you think to yourself, oh, you know, once you've been in that situation before, this is going to make it so much harder than it would, you know, when you just have free reign to kind of write whatever sort of comes to you and cover every single topic that ever crossed your mind. And you really got to kind of whittle it down.
And yet in this Twitterverse that we live in today, you could tweet this book. I mean,
my God, that's a fantastic idea.
We'll start right after this broadcast.
I'm going to start the minute I walk out of this studio.
But you know, people have short attention spans, and you will satisfy them.
Oh, yeah. It's funny you bring that up. I think there's even a Twitter novel writing contest that was going on this month or next month. In all seriousness,
wow.
So you know, it's not a bad idea. We might have to give that a shot. It is very good for the short attention span among us. Yes.
But you don't when you read through it, you don't feel like you've missed out. I don't know what you edited out, what information we are missing, but the information that we get is it's pure protein. It's packed.
We wanted it to be fun. We wanted it to be, you mentioned protein, easily digestible, you know, something that could – the longer, more in-depth information, we hope, are the conversations that spring from what's in the book, the debates that can come out of what we chose to put in the book or not to put in the book.
Well, let's talk about that, because if I counted the table of contents, there are 40 things that you chose 40. To put in the book. And that's got to be difficult, because there's a lot of stuff every American should know. And you chose 40. How did you arrive at those 40?
Because we're married.
So many arguments.
Yeah, I was going to say, because we're married, it tends to result in an argument. But the good thing here is that we had an editor who, from the very beginning, knew exactly what he wanted to have in here in terms of the length.
So why didn't he write the book?
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
So if we came up with a list. Denise and I sat down and came up with a list of things that we thought were significant, important. And one of the things that could have been in here was, for example, 10 movies that have changed America. That would have been a fun list to do, and we talked about doing that, but in the end, that was never chosen.
That would be so popular.
Oh, sure. You could easily, and we've talked about doing a follow-up to this, because there were, before we actually got writing, Joe and I and the editor had a lot of conversations about the kinds of things that we wanted to be in here, and we wanted them to be topics that felt like real cultural touchstones for Americans. And, you know, I'm an Army brat, so I grew up kind of all over the place. And one of the things that fascinated me as a kid and really continues to as an adult is how you can go, because we lived in different parts of the country, and you can go from, you know, Charlotte to New York City to St. Louis to the West Coast. And it's like we have so many different countries in this one fantastic country. And so what are those things that sort of, you know, unite us all and that we have in common or that seem familiar to most of us? And they didn't necessarily have to be you've read the book, they didn't necessarily have to be serious and weighty, right, but just something that felt truly American. And that was the real inspiration. So that's where most of the conversations before the writing began and before the whittling down to get to the 40 topics.
Well, you mentioned that one of the things that you thought about covering was the 10 movies that changed America. That didn't make the book, but 10 books every American should read did make it. And I'm curious as to why movies wouldn't make it when everybody knows nobody reads in America anymore.
I think that's...
That might be just because we were two writers.
I think that's obvious. There's certainly things that you cut out. There's things that you leave in. One of the things that struck me when I started getting feedback about the previous books we had done was you know, we did a book about the signers of the Declaration of Independence. Now, that is a book that is about 250 pages. And what we started hearing was that people were buying that book, taking it to – this is why I mentioned the bratwursts off-air earlier. Yeah. People were bringing them to barbecues on 4th of July and sort of reading, you know, factoids from that book about the different signers. And that kind of to be completely earnest, it touched me because I thought – how often do people read at a barbecue? How often do they read aloud to their friends and family? Mm-hmm. And that idea seemed kind of interesting. And so I think this book falls into that vein even more. It's the sort of book that you can kind of dip in and out and say, you know, did you know The Common Sense was the number one book that changed America? That kind of thing. That's sort of why we.
Yeah. So since this was a book that we hoped people would, you know, bust out on 4th of July, we thought there should be maybe some other books in here that would inspire people to kind of share a bit of American culture.
Well, let's talk about those books. Mm-hmm. The 10 books that every American should read.
This already
referenced Common Sense from 1776, Thomas Paine's book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Oh, no. I was just going to say this and foods are the two topics that we get the most, I'll say, excited response. That's the polite way to say it. There was actually we did a radio show out of New York City not long ago. And these two sections, the books and the food, resulted in just thousands of comments about why did they leave this out, why did they do this. Mm-hmm. But yes, we started with we have Common Sense, and
that's the book that Thomas Paine wrote to encourage Americans to be in favor of the Revolutionary War,
right. Yeah.
To break away from the British.
Oh yeah,
and he made the case in that book.
It's a beautiful book. It's that first essay is the one that begins, "These are the times that try men's souls."
Mm.
And
that's all anybody remembers from that book.
That's right, exactly. And he fell out of favor with his later works, but this one was embraced. George Washington had that particular essay read to his troops. He had a lot of things read to his troops, which we found out when we wrote our last book. Number two on the list, if I can just mention a few of them, the Federalist Papers was making the case for the acceptance or ratifying of the Constitution. And that was an important series of articles because at the time, if you know anything about that period in time, it was not popular. The thought that we would all join together as a single nation under a Constitution, which was formed a very strong government, was very unpopular, was a hard sell to most Americans. And so the three authors who put together the Federalist Papers had to really persuade Americans in a very crucial time in their history. The nation would have been bankrupt had it continued under the Articles of Confederation, mm-hmm. which was the document that was unifying them at the time.
Yeah, we might have talked about this the last time we were on your show, but it was sometimes when we think about that period in history, we think, well, once the Revolutionary War was over, everything was hunky-dory and we were all set and we were in a new country. But there was a terrific amount of disarray taking place, and how to bring this brand new country, these colonies that had been operating, you know, pretty separately,
mm-hmm.
even though they interacted with each other, they were, you know, their own little communities. How they were going to come together, and once that Constitution was set up, it had to be ratified.
We have to stop. We're going to come back and talk about this book and about this chapter in the book, the 10 books that every American should read in just a second. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and McCall Center for Visual Art, presenting the 5th annual Palette to Palette, Friday, December 7th, featuring 7 artists paired with 7 wines, live music, and silent auction. Tickets and information at mccallcenter.org. And Leap Design, a full-service graphic design studio providing brand identity and design services for businesses and organizations. Details at leapdesign.com. Well, when we talk in the past, when we've talked in the past about reducing our dependence on fossil fuels, the discussion usually gets bogged down into whether or not we should do it because of global warming, whether there is global warming, whether we can do anything about it, whether we're responsible for it. But there's a filmmaker out there, Peter Bick, who decided to change the conversation by eliminating any question of global warming. He's lined up folks who are doing something about this simply because they think it's the right thing to do. And we will meet him and talk with him about this Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. A deal to avoid the fiscal cliff is taking shape. A fight over UN Ambassador Susan Rice heats up. And President Obama lunches with Mitt Romney. The week's top national stories, what happened and why.
Join the Diane Rehm Show and the News Roundup this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Denise Kiernan and Joe Dagnese are our guests, or Joe Dagnese, authors of Stuff Every American Should Know. And we were talking about the 10 books every American should read, which is one of the chapters, which goes from page 56. My God. To 61. This is the longest chapter in the book.
Thank you very much.
So we talked about the Common Sense and the Federalist Papers. Uncle Tom's Cabin is on the list. Huckleberry Finn is on the list. Gone with the Wind is on the list. The Grapes of Wrath, John Steinbeck's great novel from 1939, on the list. Invisible Man, Catch-22, Silent Spring, and Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. Nothing beyond 1970. And I'm curious as to why, because these are the 10 books that changed America, right? Kind of.
Well, this is what we argue about with our with our editor. What we wanted was were books that had some kind of tie-in to American history, where if you read, you know, say, through them, you'd get a sense of what the American people were going through at different periods of time.
Then where is Upton Sinclair in this?
Well, he's number 11, and we decided
you had to stop someplace.
But if you look at something, I mean, Gone with the Wind was one that we were all completely on board with for several different reasons that kind of speak to some of the criteria we had in mind for many topics in the book.
And our own biases, probably.
Yeah, probably. I mean, it's a spectacular book.
Right.
Here was a book that depicted a certain kind of life in America that's uniquely American, mm-hmm. that was uniquely American. So it was definitely unique to American culture and American history. It was tremendously popular. The millions of copies of this book that have been sold is mind-boggling. And it won the Pulitzer. So it wasn't just popular, it was also critically acclaimed. And the movie that resulted from it has also become
iconic.
Iconic in American culture. So that
would the movie have made the movie list?
Yeah.
Had there been a movie list?
Oh, sure. If there had been a movie list, it would have. I think it would have definitely made the movie list.
Many years ago, I actually interviewed a gentleman who is a reporter at Variety, who does every year does the, I think it's the 100 films of all time, and he always goes by box office. What are the box office wins? And when I talked to him, this was maybe the mid '80s, maybe late '80s, '90s. And what he said was, you know, even for its time, Gone with the Wind was incredible because in the sense that the conditions that made Gone with the Wind an amazing movie, a box office success then, don't exist today. In 1939, you could go to the movies. You would not have the expectation that you could see that movie later on television.
Right.
So TV's off the table. You could not have the expectation that it would be available to rent as a video. So that's off the table. If you wanted to see that movie, that experience again, you had to go to the theater, and people did in droves. The number of tickets sold for Gone with the Wind, the movie version, was still probably at the top of that guy's list. Now, I haven't checked
this year,
but I mean, I will probably stake that. I think number two on that list was E.T.
Hmm.
And that was with television, and I think the expectation of video at some point.
Now, in the break, you were talking about you wrote a piece about that, this chapter about the books for the Huffington Post.
Yes, they did it as a slideshow. Yeah.
Okay, and you got a lot of reactions.
Oh, boy, yes. There were, I think it was in excess of 3,000 comments within maybe the first day. I think they posted it on a Friday, and I forget where the numbers were by
Monday. That surprised me anyway, because I do run a – I actually do have a little blog where I occasionally write, pontificate about my thoughts. And I'm lucky if I get one or two comments a day. That would be a big day for me. to have somebody respond to the point of 3,000 was kind of bizarre. But as always, it's the sort of thing you get some people who are saying like, wow, I've read 8 out of the 10. You know, yay for me. And then other people are like, I can't believe they didn't put, you know, whatever on the list. Right. I can't believe that they put Grapes of Wrath. That book was discredited years ago. Or Silent Spring or whatever. That kind of thing. So there's negative and positive everywhere you look on the internet.
But what was great is it accomplished what we were hoping, which was that people would see this and go, oh, let's talk about more books.
How long has this been out, your book?
This came out in June.
Okay.
June,
yeah.
July, right.
I don't know whether you get to see comments or whether you are aware. I guess you go to book signings. People talk about this book, but they haven't read it yet usually because they've just bought it and they want you to sign it. But Newsweek did an article, and several local TV stations have done short pieces. And, of course, Jay Leno does this thing where he goes out on the street and asks questions about America to people. And it's astounding what people don't know. I mean, it's frightening what they don't know. And the article in Newsweek shows that most Americans don't know about some of the most momentous moments in American history. Are people coming up to you and saying, wow, I didn't know that? Because some of this stuff is pretty elemental.
Some of the, you know, it's funny that you mention Jay Leno. I've seen Jay Leno when he does that. It's a classic. I talked to WNYC, did the same thing with our book. And the man on the street, or woman on the street, as it were at the time, and asking questions. And it is quite astounding. I think more when we're out interacting with people at signings, I think it's more of a – we get such enthusiasm about wanting to know more about history or, you know, cultural history, either, you know, straight-up history, serious history, or cultural history. Mm-hmm. And it is what's funny to me, it is a little shocking some of the things that people don't know. And one of the things that we talk about in the book, and we actually wrote in a large op-ed about this for Newsday this summer, is the confusion between the Declaration and the Constitution.
You talk about that in the book.
We do. We call it the Declitution. We like to call it the Declitution.
And I believe you talk about how even politicians get the two documents mixed up in terms of what they mean to America and what force of law they have in America. And I believe there's an example – I couldn't think of what it was, but I believe I heard in this last campaign an example of that.
Oh, I'm sure you did.
I
don't want to mention any names either. Let's just say there are faux pas on every side.
Yes. To be clear, the Declaration of Independence has no force of law.
No.
At all.
Well,
nice document.
It expired
Thank
in 1776.
That's
yes,
right.
Exactly. It is the document that announced we were breaking
right
with England. It is a very inspirational document. This is who we are. This is what we stand for. And then it's a very long laundry list of complaints.
Grievances.
Yeah, against the king. But it's a very inspirational document, which is why, I don't know, in my opinion, I feel like people bring the Declaration up a lot more than they do the Constitution.
So the Constitution begins with "We the People," and the Declaration begins with "When in the course of human events."
Yes, okay. Exactly. Yeah, and the Constitution is really our playbook for our government. I mean, the Constitution is the playbook you go to for how they sat down after these colonies joined together and said, what the heck is this? What is this new place going to look like, and how are we going to run it?
The words that get people confused, I think, is when the most famous lines from the Declaration of Independence are the lines that say, all men are created equal, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, our gut reaction, our assumption is that that is such a part of what it means to be American, mm-hmm. that it must be in the Constitution. But it's not in the Constitution. It's in the Declaration of Independence. What is interesting, and we can jump ahead a century, is that the gentleman who actually put those words on the map as far as saying this is what it means to be American is Abraham Lincoln. And we actually were able to put in this book, the Gettysburg Address, where he combines all of these things into basically a 10-sentence speech that he gave at the Gettysburg battlefield. And when we were researching the Declaration of Independence, we found that many times historians would say the origin of what we say is Americanness begins with Lincoln linking this document, the Declaration of Independence, to the importance of the Union.
You know, he got so many things right in that very short speech. He followed a guy who was a famous orator of the time who got up there on this very cold day and spoke for 2.5 hours. Mm-hmm. Lincoln wrote this on the way the story goes that he wrote this speech on the way to Gettysburg on the train on the back of an envelope and thought that he had failed miserably after he had made the speech. And he says this one line in the speech that he could not be more wrong about, and that is, "The world will little note nor long remember what we say here."
Yeah,
his is the only thing people remember about
on the back of an envelope.
Yeah,
it's funny, and I'm probably gonna get this quote wrong. That very same orator wrote Lincoln after that event at Gettysburg, and essentially to sum up what he said basically, "It took me 2.5 hours to say what you said more eloquently and more directly in, 2 minutes," and was just so impressed by how Lincoln was able with such brevity to capture so much of – it's possibly the most quoted address
You should feel proud that your book is brief, because his entire speech, all of the Gettysburg Address, is carved on the wall of the Lincoln Memorial.
That's you couldn't do that.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful memorial.
It's beautiful.
I love that memorial.
Yeah. Everything about it is beautiful. There's something in the book that troubled me near the beginning. The premise here, of course, is there are certain things you should know as an American. But in the second sentence of your book, you say, "The names of all the presidents in the order in which they served, maybe not. Don't need to know that." Well, that's the one thing we had to memorize when I was in school.
Oh, did you really?
Yes.
Millard Fillmore, quick.
But
yeah, exactly.
I don't remember.
James K. Polk.
We have Google now. We don't need that anymore. But is that why you don't have to remember that, but you should know the first stanza to the Star-Spangled Banner, which, by the way, you've printed the entire Star-Spangled Banner here, and the other stanzas are horrible.
Yeah,
as poetic by a long shot.
Although I will say, this is the marvelous age we live in. You can go online to YouTube and you can actually find there was some sort of a political rally where some gentleman raised a hand and said, "I think it's terrible that most people don't even know, all of the Star-Spangled Banner." And he begins to sing the last stanza, which is the one which I think Francis Scott Key actually uses the phrase, "In God we trust," right. "In God is our trust," or something like that. And this man begins singing, and it's actually one of the more emotionally powerful YouTube videos, but aside from the cat videos, of course, that you can see on there.
Aside from cats singing the Star-Spangled Banner.
No, but the people who were standing around him were visibly moved, and it was quite an amazing thing. But you're right. Those words are not nearly as powerful as the first stanza, when you can actually visualize what he was seeing that night in 1814.
I was surprised, and most people probably know this, maybe that's why you didn't put it in the book, but you talk a lot about why this was written, when it was written, by whom it was written, and then you write the actual words of the Star-Spangled Banner. But you don't mention that it's set to the tune of an English drinking song.
Yes. Which also has a horrible name, the Ancreatic Song, which I have no idea what that
means. It sounds like pancreatic. It's just bad.
It's just a bad. Yeah. But that was a very common thing. I mean, we know, off the top of my head, we have borrowed a number of songs from Great Britain, which we have repurposed Francis Hopkinson.
Our country tis of thee.
Yeah, our country tis of thee. God save the king.
Francis Hopkinson, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, did that with one of his sort of ditties that he used during the war. And Yankee Doodle, I think, also started as a British song, which we tweaked it to be something else. And we did the same thing with Christmas songs. I think Greensleeves became our.
It's the earliest evidence of remixes.
Yeah.
It's just patriotic remixes.
Well, you have a list of patriotic songs that every American should know. I'm trying to find it in the book here.
It's way at the end.
Way at the end. here it is.
36.
Yankee Doodle. I think everybody knows Yankee Doodle.
Maybe not
anymore. There needs to be a rap song set to Yankee Doodle.
Oh, my gosh. That's a great idea.
Yeah. Stars and Stripes Forever. Mm-hmm. You're a Grand Old Flag, George M. Cohan. This Land Is Your Land, which you say is one of the most beloved patriotic songs of America. You're probably right about that.
I love that song.
I do, too.
I never get tired of that song.
I love the Battle Hymn of the Republic. I'm glad that made the list. The Star-Spangled Banner, My Country, Tis of Thee, written by Reverend Samuel Smith. I didn't know this. In 1831, inspired when Smith was translating a book of German patriotic songs for his friend Lowell Mason, and it's written to the tune of the British tune, God Save the King. America the Beautiful. Coming to America. I'm so sad that is on there. And God Bless America by Irving Berlin. Neil Diamond makes the list.
Well, it's actually what's hilarious actually about number 10 is that I understand that Woody Guthrie hated God Bless America, and it inspired him to write This Land Is Your Land. Now, the version of This Land Is Your Land that I learned that was sort of printed in my sort of grade school songbook is very different from this sort of rebel-rousing song that Woody Guthrie wrote, and you know, which is available almost anywhere these days, with him singing it, available from the Smithsonian, I might add. So that's kind of an interesting thing. It's a patriotic song, but it was also sort of a painful song as he sang it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was an activist is not the right word to use here, but he was a social commentary.
Yeah,
his
guitar said this machine kills anarchists or slays anarchists or something or tyrants.
There's a lot of information here. Almost every chapter begins with a question, and your first question is, where did America get its name? And my first thought was, doesn't everybody know? But maybe everybody doesn't know.
That was actually – it's funny you bring that up. That was actually one of the man-on-the-street questions they did in one of our prior interviews. And the answer – I wish I could remember some of the answers, but nobody knew. They asked. They probably went through five or six people, and then one guy came really close. And I think he called him Vespucco or something. So he got really close. But it was
Amerigo Vespucci.
Amerigo Vespucci. Yes.
Why don't people know that? How do I know that?
It's how do you? Yeah, how do you know? That's actually excellent that you know that. It's.
Well, when I was a kid, I know because for two reasons.
Well, we're Italian. So,
one, yeah. I'm an Italian-American. My mother was born in Italy. So, of course, I was going to learn something about Amerigo Vespucci. Yeah. And I was going to learn how to pronounce it beautifully. Amerigo Vespucci. Okay. But I actually did do a paper as a kid about Amerigo Vespucci, and his maps stunk.
We'll come back and talk more about that. And why Colombia? I don't get that either. Well, I really don't get that. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Aldi of Charlotte on Independence Boulevard in Matthews, inside the 485 Beltway, and online at aldiofcharlotte.com. Directions and inventory available at aldiofcharlotte.com. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the National News Roundup at 10 o'clock. Some of the stories that Diane and her panel will cover include a deal to avoid the so-called fiscal cliff that's taking shape, a fight over U.N. Ambassador Susan Rice heating up, and President Obama lunching with former Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney. The International Hour will follow at 11. And if you'd like to join our conversation right now about stuff every American should know, maybe you want to stump the panel. Okay, you could do that too, I suppose. At 704-926-WFAE, that's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
As 2012 draws to a close, we want to thank you for listening to and supporting WFAE. Please ensure the programming you rely on to keep you informed is here for you in 2013 by making your tax-deductible investment now. Call 704-549-9000 or give at WFAE.org. Pledge by midnight, December 31st, and you'll be automatically entered to win a trip to the Azores. No pledge is necessary to enter, but we hope you'll support WFAE. Thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Denise Kiernan and Joe Dagnese are with us. Stuff Every American Should Know is the name of their latest book, something everybody should have. Well, I wouldn't put it on the bookshelf because you'll never find it again. It's so small. But you could put it in your back pocket and carry it around with you, and you'll be a genius at wherever you go about America. America, and we were talking just before the break about where we got our name, from Amerigo Vespucci. Why? Was he a cartographer? Was he an explorer? What was his story?
He was a Florentine explorer and made as many as 4 trips to the quote-unquote New World.
Before or after?
Although 2 of those are disputed. After
Columbus.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening is that back in those days, well, even today, a publisher can just decide to start publishing books in order to make money. And even if they were basically spreading lies and disinformation, this is what happened to a lot of the writings of Amerigo Vespucci. They were published by a sort of a spurious publisher, and they fell into the hands of a very earnest printer, German printer, whose name is printed here, but I have no idea how to pronounce it. I'll defer to my German-born wife.
Valdis Müller.
Yeah.
Valdis Müller.
Martin Valdis Müller in 1507 printed the first map, and he basically called these continents or all the maps America.
Why not Amerigo?
Exactly.
He wanted to feminize it for some reason.
Okay.
Very common thing to have done.
Okay.
And when he released the maps, he wrote, "I can see no reason why anyone would object to calling this after the man of great ability who discovered it." Now, I know that today there was the phrase "discovering America" is a very touchy thing, but think back then in Europe, Western Europe, they would have assumed Columbus was the man.
And from their point of view, he did discover.
Exactly, the
Native Americans knew about it, but
exactly.
We didn't know about them, right?
So. Exactly. Well, shortly after this, Waldis Müller figures out that he's been had, that a lot of what he's been reading about America's travels are actually wrong. And at that point, he tries to cover up the screw-up by releasing new maps that say Terra Incognita, or Land Unknown, or Unknown Land. And, of course, by then, the maps are spread all over Europe, and people are starting to refer to these places as the Americas. Mm-hmm. What's interesting here, and the quote that I like a lot, is Ralph Waldo Emerson, the transcendental writer and poet, said many years later, he's actually attacking Amerigo for having stolen what should have rightly been Columbus's to name. And he says, "Strange that America must wear the name of a thief. Amerigo Vespucci managed in his lying world to supplant Columbus and baptize half the earth with his own dishonest name." So there you have it. That's the gentleman from Massachusetts. But anyway.
There is only one, supposedly, one known map left of Waldis Müller's map that has America on there. And the Library of Congress shelled out $10 million. For it.
Wow.
So, and it's on display
so
in Washington, D.C. The original America map.
Columbia, the gem of the ocean, and this is not in your book, but Columbia, the gem of the ocean is another patriotic song. And I've always wondered why Columbia? I know Columbus was responsible in the European point of view for discovering America. But why Columbia? Why not Columbus?
Why not Columbus?
Finds the gem of the ocean. And why is it the gem of the ocean?
If you look at the
it's very, not an island.
What I'll say is that if you look at the very top of our nation's Capitol building, mm-hmm. Where Congress is housed, you will see a statue that is the embodiment of Columbia. And it's a woman, mm-hmm. just like the Statue of Liberty is a woman, and she's the embodiment of liberty. In art throughout history, we always try to remake ideals as represent them as the feminine. It's what we do. So we have the District of Columbia, and I suppose maybe
we were almost very close to being called Columbia.
Columbia.
Hmm. All right. This is not just about American documents or the name of the country. There's all kinds of things in here that you might be surprised to find. For instance, you want to know who's responsible for blue jeans. and I actually was quite surprised because my answer would have been the obvious answer. And it's not true.
Levi Strauss is not the answer. In fact, to answer this question, and there is not really one single answer, you have to go on a voyage to India, France,
yes.
and Italy in the 16th century. And in the 16th century, of course, so much interaction between different countries occurred in ports.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was transferred around by ship. Ports in different countries were hubs of intercultural activity. Currency was exchanged that way, spices, fabrics. There was a military fort in India called Dongari.
Mm.
Does that sound familiar? That produced a very sturdy blue cloth that was very helpful for people who were constantly traveling on ships and you know, it's a very rough lifestyle and had to stand up to water and things of that nature. Travelers moving between the East and Europe picked up on this fabric that showed up again in Genoa, Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The French also picked up on this fabric, often referred to the fact that it came from Genoa, which they called Jean. So, and blue in French is?
Bleu.
Bleu. So you have the bleu de Jean, blue jeans.
Who knew?
But there was also in France, the fabric was the serge of, are you familiar with the town Nîmes?
Mm-hmm.
So it was the serge de Nîmes, denim.
Denim.
Yeah.
You know, when we were having all this flack over French fries, it should have been over blue jeans.
Exactly. Yet again, another French-American connection. So this story, perhaps, I wouldn't say more than everything. It just cracks me up. This fabric going from a military fort in India to Genoa to France, and we actually get, we say, some people in America say dungarees,
uh-huh.
some people in America say blue jeans, and some people in America say denim. I love it. But Levi Strauss obviously did play a large role in this country.
I was going to say that my Italian cousin actually refers to them as Levis.
Ah.
That's right, Levis.
Okay. Levis. Actually, Levi Strauss was in the right place at the right time. He opened a mercantile exchange on the West Coast around the time of the gold rush in America and began selling these pants. To strengthen them, he would put these copper rivets, which Levi still uses to mm-hmm. this day. The interesting thing now, I have looked for this everywhere, and we put it in the book because I'm pretty sure it's 100% true. It is the crotch rivet, which is a little piece of copper that went right at the crotch mm-hmm. that held those four or five seams together very, very well. But if you're a cowboy or a miner sitting in front of a campfire, that would conduct heat to a very
yes,
sensitive part
yes.
of the body very quickly.
Yeah.
So that was dropped.
Ah. I guess those who are anti-Francophile will be very upset if further research proves that
Wrangler
Wrangler
came from France. Wrangler. We just celebrated Thanksgiving, and that's something we all know became a national holiday when the Pilgrims decided to thank their Native American hosts with turkey and dressing served family style in a field next to Plymouth Rock on the third Thursday of November in 1621. That's right, isn't that? That's in your book, isn't that in your book?
Yeah, beautifully done. That was like chapters 4 and 5 right there, two sentences.
I got it completely wrong. It was actually December 13th, 1621, and there was no turkey. What did they eat?
Well, you trussed up the holiday eel, most likely. There's so much debate about what was eaten, and food historians point to what would have been. I mean, let's remember the first winter here was not a pleasant one for these folks. Mm-hmm. The second one was this wonderful harvest that they wanted to celebrate. And they would have really just eaten what was readily available in that area at that time of year. So, eels is often mentioned, oysters.
We have geese. We have venison. At one point, it says during the Thanksgiving feast, which actually went on for a couple of days, some of the men went off with the Native Americans and went hunting, and they returned with wild fowl. But they don't exactly say what the species are, and even if they had, I wouldn't trust 100% that that what those expressions of what those species were would live to this day. No one mentions turkey.
And maybe they were doing deep fried grouse, you know.
And I doubt that they were deep fried. And these were pilgrims.
These were pilgrims,
not Puritans. There's a difference.
There is a difference.
There is a small but important difference that goes back to the Reformation.
Right. The Puritans were the people who felt that the Church of England needed to purify itself of its Roman Catholic origins.
Okay.
The people who wanted to actually break away from the Church of England, the Separatists, ended up leaving England altogether. They went first to the Netherlands and then later boarded a little ship called the Mayflower and came to the Americas, or the New World. They are known as the Pilgrims. They dubbed themselves Pilgrims, small p, on the trip over here. We continue to call them Pilgrims. The Puritans, they stayed in England. They wanted to kind of reconcile with the Church of England. Eventually, they fell out of favor and ended up packing their things and coming to America and forming the Massachusetts Bay Colony as well.
They're the ones involved in the witch hunts.
Yes, they're
in. Yes, that fun little episode of American
now,
History.
I want to talk about something that I referenced in the opening of the program, and that is fireworks. We celebrate the 4th of July with fireworks. I actually know why we do that. And I knew it because I've been in a play called 1776, in which I played John Adams.
Did you really?
Oh, perfect!
Yes. And it's because of John Adams.
Oh, it is. Can I actually read that? It's so lovely. I think he wrote a letter to his wife Abigail, saying that he thought that the second day of July, and we'll come back to that in a second, the second day of July, 1776, will be a memorable epoch in the history of America. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp, shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of the continent to the other from this time forward forever.
Illuminations
meaning fireworks.
July 2nd.
July 2nd, yes.
How could he get the date wrong? He was there.
He was there.
But think about it. July 2nd, he sat down and he wrote this letter to his wife, Abigail, and that was the day that is the true American birthday. It's the date that was met those men, 50 or so men in Congress voted for independence. And so as far as he thought, you know, July 2nd would be that day. Mm-hmm. But what ended up happening was that if they were going to do it that way, they should have put that date at the top of the Declaration of Independence. But instead they put July 4th at the top of the Declaration of Independence, which was the day that they adopted or accepted that document. And when it went out and was publicized and went up and down the East Coast in various newspapers of the day, that date, July 4th, became the day. And in fact, as you see later in their lives, all the men who signed the Declaration of Independence are telling reporters that they signed July 4th, 1776. Right. And that continues actually to be a little bit of a mystery. Some historians say maybe they did sign something on July 4th, 1776. Mm. The real declaration was not signed until August.
Interesting. And July 4th happens to be the day that both John Adams and Thomas Jefferson died in the same year, at the same day on the same year.
Within hours, yeah.
Something else that's in your book, you talk about foods and you talk about sports. There was an old commercial jingle several years ago for Chevrolet that said, you know, Chevrolet is as American as baseball, hot dogs, and apple pie.
Mm-hmm.
Baseball, hot dogs, and apple pie all in your book. None of them are American.
The origins of all of those things can be traced elsewhere. What can we say? We're a country of immigrants, sure.
And we import our food and our pie.
Yes, hot dogs. Oh, hot dogs, when we were talking earlier about some of the excited reactions that the 10 books list got, the foods list got a big one too, and people get very upset about the hot dogs. They're Frankfurters.
Mm-hmm.
They're Frankfurters.
Well, you know, they were trying to say that you should buy an American car, Chevrolet, with that jingle. Chevrolet, right. Hot baseball, apple pie, hot dogs, and Chevrolet.
Mm-hmm.
Chevrolet isn't American either. At least not originally.
I grew up in the 70s. Maybe it was then.
Chevrolet. Ranglais.
We're almost out of time, but I also want to talk about the Pledge of Allegiance. Not written to be strictly American. Who knew?
I still think it's a beautiful, but the reason we include it, of course, is because it is such a touchstone of what it means to be American. I mean, I assume we don't have kids, but I assume they still stand up in the morning and pledge allegiance to the flag.
You know, we could have read this book in the time it took to do this show, and we haven't even scratched the surface of this book in this program.
That's good. Well, but what it does is it gets you talking, which is exactly what we were kind of hoping it would do.
I have a feeling if you started doing this in front of at a friend's house over 4th of July, you probably wouldn't get to the rest of the book either.
Because you get embroiled in conversation. Joe Dagnese, Denise Kiernan, the authors of Stuff Every American Should Know. Every American should own this book. That should be the next title. A book that every American should own. Thank you for the hour's fun.
Thank you so much.